Hello and welcome to Pivot to Asia, a new program on Radio Sputnik that concentrates on the eastern half of our planet. The West has perhaps been caught off guard by what is happening right now in Korea. The north and south of the country are apparently on the verge of opening up diplomatic negotiations, despite the will of the United States of America. And this is happening under the aegis of the Olympics, now taking place in South Korea. To talk about this development, I welcome to the program Dr. Leonard Petrov, a visiting fellow in the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University in Canberra. Welcome to the program, Dr. Petrov.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Now, if we can first take a look at some of the possible reasons of why this is happening. And my first question is as follows. You know, when the North Korean leader Kim Il-sung proposed resuming talks with South Korea in his New Year's Day address, Seoul seemed to leap at the opportunity. And now some are saying that the reason that South Korean President Moon Jae-in is so keen is because he wanted to make the most of the Olympics with a presumed political payoff at home. Now, what is this political payoff and how important is it for him?
Right. Well, President Moon Jae-in was elected under the promise that he would improve relations with North Korea.
Right.
Because for a long 10 years of the conservative government in South Korea, the relationship which had existed between North and South Korea was just unwinding. The zones of economic cooperation were closing down. Mm-hmm. The Kumgansan resort on the eastern outskirts of the demilitarized zone was also shut down after the South Korean tourist was shot by the North Korean guard. Mm. The previous governments in South Korea used to develop relations with North Korea or otherwise freeze relations with North Korea. The pendulum was going left and right, and it looks like after the 10 years of complete freeze, now we are opening again another 10 years of era, which was known as the Sunshine Policy era or
right.
Peace and Prosperity Policy of era, where current President Moon Jae-in was the architect of the philosophy of Sunshine Policy, so-called unconditional help and assistance to North Korean brothers and sisters. The former president of South Korea, Kim Tae-jung and Noh Moo-hyun, they were the supporters of the policy, but Moon Jae-in basically was working behind the scenes. He was known as a lawyer. He developed this policy, which was designed to make unification of Korea maybe not sooner, but at least less traumatic. The so-called soft landing method was developed by South Korean strategists to pump North Korea with money, permit North Korea to engage with South Korea, with the rest of the world, to mitigate the burden which South Korean taxpayers one day would need to bear and foot the bill of unification. So it's purely pragmatic for South Korean strategists in one way, and it's pretty natural to see that the better relations between North and South, the more peaceful environment it is going to be on the peninsula.
Right.
Otherwise, if you start antagonizing and threatening, and not only through propaganda war, but through arms race, in bringing the, you know, like nuclear armed aircrafts and air carriers and other assets from overseas with American partners, then North Korea would have no other way but just to weaponize their own ballistic missile programs and detonate nuclear devices. And so it's pretty logical to see it's better at the moment. North and South Koreans are neighbors who didn't talk to each other for a long 10 years. But if you remember that in the previous years, there were zones of cooperation, charter flights, unification train was crossing the demilitarized zone, tourists from South Korea could drive their own cars across the demilitarized zone and visit their loved ones whom they haven't seen for decades after the Korean War. So I think it's pretty logical to assume that it's better to have peace and good relationship and economic and prosperity programs rather than no relationship, kind of military nuclear standoff without any certainty about what is going to happen tomorrow.
Now, what do the peoples, though? I mean, it's very important what you said, actually, that the South Korean president was elected under a mandate, basically, of establishing better relations with the North. Now, is that a major factor in the psychology and the mindset of South Koreans and North Koreans? I mean, how do the people think about this? We hear all the time about what the politicians think, but what do ordinary people think in both halves of the country?
Well, in general, any Korean in North or South Korea, young and old, would tell you that unification of the country is their dream, cherished dream.
Right.
One day they want to see their country unified. Everyone talks about unification, but It depends what next question is going to be. Are you going to pay the unification tax? Are you going to give your job to the brothers and sisters from North Korea who would probably, who would agree to be paid just half of your salary? And they, of course, they would say, no. Let's have unification sometime in the future. Not in my age.
Right.
Not right now. And technically, we don't need to unify. We need South Koreans are ready to see North Korea as a new colony, a kind of new territory which needs to be civilized and become like this and liberated and emancipated. That's what South Koreans look at it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I'm thinking of the example of West and East Germany, you know, when the wall came down and suddenly...
It's a good parallel, you know, but like any comparison, it's not perfect because East Germany was known to be the most prosperous country of the communist bloc.
Yeah.
As opposed to North Korea, which was known as the poorest or one of the poorest countries of the communist bloc. And of course, the difference, the gap between rich and poor in East and West Germany was not that dramatic compared to, say, South Korean rich and North Korean poor, where the governments of North Korea controls all the assets, but the majority of people live on, say, $5 per month.
Mm-hmm.
That's the average salary in North Korea. So even in East Germany, wasn't the disparity between the wealth was not that much. So between North and South Korea, the gap is counted as about 36 times. And
yeah,
it's just it's a very conservative approach to it, because if you look at the level of education and level of skills and other competitiveness of North Koreans, they are definitely lower than South Koreans, who have excellent education, who speak languages, who modern nation, very well connected through computer and mobile devices to the rest of the world. So South Korea is part of the member of the OECD and the largest, like 13th largest economy in the world, while North Korea is still one of the poorest countries in the world. So this gap actually worried those people who believed that the soft landing would make this process less painful, and sooner or later, North and South Koreans can talk about unification, but only after the long process of joint collaboration, cooperation, and education would be needed. So that's why President Moon Jae-in's thesis is that reconciliation must go first, and economic cooperation second, and unification next. And denuclearization, well, that's something what actually kind of makes the whole story very convoluted and extremely complicated, because North Korea is not preparing to denuclearize. And if President Moon Jae-in believes that North Korea one day is going to give up its nuclear and missile assets, it would be self-deceptive.
Mm-hmm.
North Korea believes it's potentially is under strike, that North Koreans believe that they are potentially can be targeted by, if not South Koreans, but they are American allies.
Mm-hmm.
North Korean regime is particularly paranoid about its survival. So for North Koreans, the lessons of Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi in Iraq and in Libya gave wonderful example that never give up your arms, never trust the Westerners. Don't disarm yourself unless you're given really serious, really strong
reason for doing so. Assurances.
Security assurance.
Yeah, assurances. Now, this process of communication between the North and the South, now, is it powerful enough, in your opinion, to undermine the relationship between Washington and Seoul? I mean, the Americans see their alliance with South Korea as having provided stability in the area since the end of the Korean War. And they're not going to take being shouldered out very easily, are they?
Well, the whole relationship between South Korea and the United States is based on anti-communism sentiments.
Mm.
The Korean War, which was started by North Korea and nearly was ended in a matter of weeks as a war for unification, like it was between North and South Vietnam, actually turned its tide when American and Australian and 16 other countries joined the war under the banner of anti-communism, under the pretext of containing communism in East Asia, and pushed North Korea back to the Chinese border when the Chinese actually stepped in.
Mm.
So this alliance is built on anti-communism. It's very ideological, and we probably could say that it's very political, and it's so in essence Cold War mentality, which brings together the Washington and Seoul right-wing hawkish politicians.
Right.
For Seoul and for Washington, D.C., it is important to be together, because it's not actually about North Korea, because China and Russia are just next door. And Americans want to be present in the region, and South Korea provides the place for American troops to be stationed
yeah.
on the peninsula and in Japan and elsewhere in the Pacific. So for Americans, it doesn't make sense if North and South Koreans start talk and cooperate and the friendship and reconciliation process is resumed because it would immediately undermine the whole thesis of South Korean-American brotherhood in arms built on anti-communism.
Yeah, yeah. Now, how does the present Trump administration affect the situation? I mean, Trump has questioned Seoul's alliance contributions, opened renegotiations of the long-fought-over U.S.-Korea free trade agreement, and also, of course, threatened direct military action against the North, for which the South would bear the bulk of the risk in the end of the day. I mean, that's a lot, isn't it, since he came to power?
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, the President Trump is completely inconsistent in his Korea policy, both North and South. On the one hand, he wants South Korea to be the unsinking, he wants to be South Korea a vehicle for the U.S. military policy against North Korea. But on the other side, South Korean-American free trade agreement is going to be negotiated. And already a very unfriendly move being made by U.S. State Department and trade organizations in order to protect. Protectionism is now being imposed against South Korean-made products. So
yeah.
It does make sense for South Korea to help the United States, understanding that by helping the U.S. in military, they're going to jeopardize the economic development, not only with the closing American markets, but also with the closing Chinese and Russian markets. And we saw it last year when South Korean previous government permitted the placement of THAAD anti-missile system in South Korea. China immediately announced the boycott of South Korean-made goods and banned the tourist visitations to South Korea. It badly hit South Korean economy. So South Korea now understands that they're regional power. It's good to have American benefactors and protectors across the ocean, but China and Russia and North Korean brothers and sisters actually are much closer. And North Korea is full of natural resources which potentially may be useful for South Korean economy. And if a relationship between North and South Korea are resumed, South Korea will benefit from this. Right now, it's China who is buying rare earth metals and other strategic minerals at half price from South Korea. But one day it may be just South Korea, also North Korean workforce, maybe not very skilled, disciplined, but not very well trained in modern sense. But still, they speak the same language. They share 5,000 years of history.
Yeah.
North Koreans, just members of the family, and of course, provide joint projects, both economic, sports, academic, humanitarian projects between North and South Koreans are going to be much stronger. And that's why Japan is very paranoid about Korean reconciliation as well. So basically, everyone is against of inter-Korean reconciliation and cooperation, but one country, and this country is Russia.
Okay.
Russia is very keen to sell its natural resources and export electricity and workforce and skilled experts to the unified Korea.
If I may interrupt you here just for a short break, and I'd like to carry on our conversation about actually China's position and Russia's position after this short break. Welcome back to Pivot to Asia program. My name is John Harrison. Today I'm talking to Dr. Leonid Petrov, a visiting fellow in the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University in Canberra, about the possibility of a thaw in relations between North and South Korea. Now, we just started talking about the position of Russia. I'd like you to please tell us, how does Moscow see this, in your opinion, and how does South Korea see Russia's actions, and what effect will it have on the whole geopolitical situation in that part of the world? And then I'd like to ask you about China.
Russia is basically sandwiched between, it's a huge country, but its policy, the two-Korea policy, which Russia actually started in the early 1990s with the Soviet Union, before the Soviet Union collapsed, Moscow diplomatically recognized South Korea, and it actually spoiled relations with the North for a decade or so.
Mm.
China did basically the same, but China is much more pragmatic and they realize that having a two-curry policy is much more beneficial for Chinese export-oriented economy. Russian economy with the focus on export of natural resources, minerals, electricity, and also the skilled workforce, the number of engineers who work for Samsung and LG and who make South Korean economy very strong. Also, tourism to South Korea also benefited the Republic of Korea significantly in the 1990s, while North Korea was still starving. But right now, the problem is that North Korea is a black hole in this quickly developing region. And for Russia, it makes much more sense to support the unification project between North and South Korea, which will open door to Russian export projects, South Korean investments in Russia. And Russian Far East is hugely underdeveloped and underpopulated. So Russia believes that if North and South Korea, well, at least start cooperating, there will be definitely more opportunities for Russian business people and for Korean business people in the Russian Far East.
Yeah.
So I think it's a win-win-win situation for Moscow, Pyongyang, and Seoul to see the reconciliation process restarted on the Korean Peninsula, maybe at the expense of South Korean-American alliance. And this is also a bonus for Moscow. They don't want to see their U.S.-allied, unified Korea just next door to Vladivostok, the headquarters of the Russian Pacific Fleet. And so China is also paranoid about potential U.S. military bases on its borders.
Yeah.
So for Russia and China, it is important to see Korea as a kind of Finland of East Asia,
right.
A neutral country which is non-aligned but prosperous, which is peaceful but vigilant, and economically, as economic powerhouse, South Korea is prepared to invest in the North, and North Korea is prepared to sell its natural resources to South Korea rather than to China or Japan.
Now, China, I think very quickly then, we've only got a few minutes left, I'd just like to ask you quickly about China's position, because as you said, it's almost like they're in a bit of schizophrenia here, isn't it? Because on the one hand, they're supporting the sanctions against North Korea, you know, because of Kim Jong-un's, you know, kind of impertinence. And on the other hand, they're, you know, flying over the demilitarized zone, the show of force to remind the South Koreans that if they, you know, they go ahead and they deploy American THAAD missile defenses, you know, that's upsetting China's strategic defense plans, you know. So they're in a very difficult situation, aren't they? I mean, how do you think they would they welcome this new move or not, this thorn in relations?
Well, China has some kind of ambivalent attitude to anything which is moving on the Korean Peninsula. Any process of, like, dynamic process in Korea is met with a great deal of suspicion in China, but as much as in Japan and in Washington, simply because nobody knows where the unified or reconciled Korean states end up. Ideally, it should be a neutral, non-aligned confederate state with North and South Korean governments having their own domestic policies, but probably joint foreign and military affairs to be controlled from a confederal government. So what China prefers is, like, there are three no's for Chinese Korea policy. One of these three premises says it should be no war in Korea. So as long as the unification or reconciliation is peaceful, that's fine.
Yeah.
No problem. There should be no nuclear weapons in Korea Peninsula. So for China, it's important that North Korea, well, at least stops testing its nuclear weapons. Probably it will never give it up unless given proper security assurance. But no testing, no experimentations on near the Chinese borders, because nuclear contamination is a terrible thing which may happen to very heavily populated provinces of Northeast China. And the third, no, for Korea, there's no regime change in, well, North Korea. So they don't want, China would not tolerate any preemptive strike or any attempt to send a subversive group which would try to depose or dethrone or decapitate the North Korean leadership, because still the Korean Workers' Party is considered to be the sister party of Chinese Communist Party.
Right.
They both fought against the Americans in 1950s during the Korean War. So there's not many communist states left in the world, and North Korea is just one of them. So for Chinese Communist Party and for Beijing, it is psychologically important to have some sort of alliance in this part of the world just next door, which serves as a buffer state, which separates its three Northeast Asian provinces, northeastern provinces of China against American allied South Korea. So as long as there's no war, there's no regime change, and there's no nuclear weapons, China is going to be comfortable with whatever is going on in Korea. And it looks like Pyongyang and Seoul right now are not going to talk war. They potentially may de-escalate the nuclear standoff. And President Moon Jae-in is happy to continue negotiations with First Secretary Kim Jong-un. Of course, Kim Jong-un cannot visit Seoul for a number of reasons, but President Moon Jae-in, I believe, will prepare necessary conditions to visit Pyongyang, something like former President Kim Tae-jung and former President Noh Moo-hyun did. And if the democratic progressive government stays in South Korea for another electoral period, we might see the resumption of the Sunshine Policy, great cooperation of North and South Korea, and probably at a new level, with or without nuclear weapons. It probably wouldn't matter, because if peace, relationship, cooperation prevails, nobody will even consider seriously the usage of nuclear weapons. It doesn't make sense.
Final question. Now, do you think that the US could actually maybe want a few months to go by while North Korea is softened up as a result of the new sanctions before agreeing to take part or even to recognize such negotiations between the North and the South? Or perhaps a thaw will actually increase the likelihood that the US will develop a thicker network of missile defenses in the South?
Right. Well, I think the U.S. policy towards Korea is fundamentally inconsistent, or if it's based on something, it is anti-communism, ideological prejudice against North Korea and its neighbors, former benefactors of North Korea, Russia, and China. So for the United States, it's important to continue and maintain these Cold War structures intact.
Yeah.
Because the worse the relationship between North and South Korea, the stronger is the relationship between Washington and Seoul. So that's a very simple sort of negative correlation between these two relationships. Of course, for North Korea, for the United States, it doesn't make sense if North and South Koreans start talk. For them, for military industrial complex of the United States, it's much more beneficial in terms of weapon sales and in terms of military alliance to keep North and South Korea as distant as possible. So any cooperation, any softening, any dialogue is problematic for U.S. policy.
Do you think that this could cause the U.S. to, you know, to let off a few missiles? I mean, do you think that this thaw could actually lead in an increased likelihood of war?
War in Korea is a problematic thing because Korea is a small place and there are much more significant players, have very, very significant stakes in the game. It's Russia and China. So what President Trump was talking about last year, you know, about fire and fury, about nuclear armada, it was just empty talk. He didn't send the nuclear armada to the shores of North Korea because the coastline of North Korea is just hundreds of kilometers away from Russian coastal line, and the Pacific Fleet is based in Vladivostok and Nakhodka. I don't think that the United States is going to jeopardize its own naval and aerial assets and the lives of hundreds of thousands of American citizens who live, work, and study in South Korea and Japan, because if the war starts there, well, it's going to be a massive loss of human life, huge contamination of the whole region, nuclear contamination, and economic disaster for everyone involved. First of all, South Korea, who would not tolerate any reckless actions. President Moon Jae-in made it very clear to President Trump that there will be no war without his consent. There will be no strike against North Korea without explicit permission of South Korean government to do so. And South Korean government is not suicidal. They know that any spark between the militaries and near or along the demilitarized zone can easily lead to uncontrollable escalation of hostilities in the peninsula and in the region in general. Because right now, the Chinese, the Russian anti-missile systems, nuclear weapons, naval and aerial assets are all set to the hair trigger alert. Just one little misunderstanding, miscalculation, misjudgment, human mistake, human error may lead to uncontrollable escalation of military confrontation, not just in Korea, but in the whole region. Nobody needs it. Nobody wants it.
Right.
And I don't think that the U.S. administration really understands the gravity of the situation. And of course, if it's done deliberately, well, it will be probably the worst tragedy of the 21st century.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it's absolutely fascinating talking to you. I'm afraid we've run out of time. I mean, I think you have to agree with me then, Dr. Petrov, that this is actually good news, isn't it, in one word?
Well, the nuclear weapons have some positive aspect. It has worked as a deterrence and prevented World War III.
No. I didn't mean the nuclear weapons are good news. I mean, what's happening with a possible thaw between the North and the South?
It's not possible thaw. It is thaw.
It's a real thaw.
It is a great, great dynamic. But again, see, had it not been for the nuclear weapons which North Korea developed in the previous years, well, the dynamic would be completely different and probably would have had a war much earlier. And
good
we don't
point.
Know where it would have led.
Very
it.
Interesting point. And I think that that will be absorbed with some perhaps controversy by some of our listeners. But that's what we're here for, to present alternative points of view. Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Leonard Petrov, visiting fellow in the College of Asia and the Pacific at the Australian National University in Canberra. And thank you very much indeed, listeners, for being with us today. I hope you've enjoyed this program. Tune in again next week. Goodbye.